World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as the leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
Swarms of Allied planes are roaring across the channel today to strike new, destructive blows at German-held Europe. Southward in the Mediterranean, our bombers have pounded Italian targets. On the Russian front, Red Army troops are maintaining pressure on the Axis-Caucasian bridgehead and are making further gains in the Donetsk region. In the Pacific, the Japs have made heavy air raids against Allied New Guinea bases. Apparently, our offensive in the Aleutians is still progressing satisfactorily. But now, for the latest developments in the North African theater, Admiral Radio takes you direct to CBS Algiers, Charles Collingwood reporting.
The late spring sun is just going down behind the mountains in Tunisia. The wildflowers nod in the meadows and the fields smell of ripe things ready for the cutting. There's not much to remind you of war in Tunisia anymore, except a field here and there crowded with German prisoners and a few bits of rusty iron almost hidden by the grass. It all ended so quickly after it had taken so long. Looking back on it, though, it wasn't really so long. 6 months to the day. It was really only 6 months ago that we had just landed. Darlan had just been confirmed in power here, and no one knew quite what to make of the strange collection of renegade Frenchmen we found. 6 months ago, the tiny force that was grandly called the First Army was pushing up the coast in a desperate attempt to reach Tunis. Then we didn't get to Tunis, but got pushed back from Jedida to Tiburba and back to Medjez El Bab. And then the winter set in, and everyone who thought that Africa was a place of sunshine and cloudless skies found that it was a place of bitter cold and rain and mud. Mud everywhere. Those of us who were here remember the boys in the mud last winter. Boys flying Spitfires and P-38s out of a flat piece in the valleys that was thick with mud, like a thousand hands pulling at the wheels, and the planes stuck to the mud like postage stamps. Up in the hills in the mud all winter long, other boys slogged up the hills and took them, and then the Germans came along and pushed them out, and they went down again and rested, and then they slogged up the hills again, and the Germans took them back, and that went on all winter long. But all winter long, the troops were coming into the ports, and pretty soon the First Army began to look like an army. The 78th British Division was joined by the 6th Armored, and then by others. The American forces that started out with the gallant little Combat Command B and Colonel Rapp's parachutists were filled out by the 1st American Armored Division, and by still more divisions. And all this while, the 8th Army was pushing the Africa Corps back from El Alamein to Benghazi, to Tripoli, to Merritt. And when the rain stopped and the mud dried and spring came, we suddenly found that we had a real army here. The 18th Army Group, it was called. The one for the First Army and the eight for the eighth. And as spring came, we saw we were going to win. The only question was how we were going to win quickly. Well, everyone knows now how General Alexander solved that one. And on the 7th of May, we went into Tunis and Bizerta, and the campaign was over. Of all the moments of that long 6 months, that was the greatest one. For the men who went into Tunis and Bizerta, that day there will never be anything like it. These were not just cities. They were symbols. Symbols of frustration and of fighting in the mud without ever enough of anything and of discomfort and misery and death. Those two cities of Tunis and Bizerta were what made it all worthwhile. I remember as we came out of Tunis that afternoon that we took it, it was raining, and all along the road there stood little groups of prisoners standing in the road in the rain. I was riding with Bill Stoneman, who was a correspondent for the Chicago Daily News. Somebody looked at the prisoners and said that they looked so miserable he almost felt sorry. And Bill Stoneman, I remember, thinking doubtless of the long months in the cold and mud, said, "I wish it was snowing." This is Charles Collingwood returning you to New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
Again this week, Admiral continues the story of one of America's greatest weapons of war, radar. You heard, and perhaps were amazed by General Eisenhower's report, that more than 1,000 Axis planes have been destroyed in a little over 3 months. Credit for this remarkable achievement goes first to the skill and training of Allied fighting men, and next to radar, the electronic instrument with superhuman power to see and hear. Radar detects the approach of enemy planes almost as soon as they leave their base, even though that base may be concealed by fog, storm, darkness, or distance. Radar not only detects these planes, but reveals their exact location, keeps close watch until our fighters can meet and blast them from the skies. Radar, built by Admiral, also performs another vital service in maintaining air supremacy. At night, American anti-aircraft batteries no longer need employ position-revealing searchlights to spot enemy bombers, for radar helps bring down enemy aircraft which aren't even seen until American shells cause them to burst into flames. Later in this program, Admiral will tell you more about the scientific principles which radar employs to perform these miracles for America. For radar, built by Admiral, is the 1943 model of America's smart set. Now here once again is Doug Edwards.
In Washington, the Navy has reported more air action in the Solomons, and the President and Prime Minister continue their conferences. For a report on these developments, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington. Eric Severide reporting.
If the fighting among the frozen boulders of Attu Island has reached a decisive stage, nobody here knows about it. The Navy is very expert at saying nothing, and nothing is said. All armchair strategists find themselves somewhat embarrassed about this fight. They don't know anything about the island, and they just can't visualize what the method of attack would be, the positions of defense. In fact, they have no idea at all of what the fighting is like. There was one short item from the Navy about the Solomons. Our torpedo plane spotted a Jap cargo ship. They put two torpedoes into its side. The vessel exploded and simply disappeared. Four Jap bombers attacked our position on Guadalcanal. One was shot down and two were damaged. Before this week is over, the bewildered income taxpayers of the country will have the answer on federal tax policy. As you know, the Senate passed the Rummel Plan. Today, even the strongest administration opponents of the bill are certain the House will accept the Senate version. As one of them said this afternoon, the momentum behind this thing is terrific. It's probable the bill won't even go to a conference committee of the two houses. With a bill as good as passed, the real question is the president's attitude. The Treasury experts who detest the Rummel bill just haven't decided whether to advise the president to veto it or let it become law. They do want the collection at the source, which the bill provides. But they still look at the cancellation features as an outrageous windfall for the very rich. To their mind, this is fiscal immorality 10 times compounded in a period of national sacrifice. The country and the world will hear Churchill on Wednesday. Right now, the course of the Anglo-American War Council here is as highly secret as it ought to be. One thing bothers many of the best political and military heads in this capital: the illusion which has taken hold of the people that Anglo-American decisions hold the key to the immediate future of the war. They would like everyone to remember one or two imposing facts. In the first place, Germany has no fewer divisions than she had a year ago. And right now, she has about 180 divisions facing the Russians. She has only about one-third that number, protecting the whole periphery of Europe from Bulgaria to Norway. There is no better evidence as to the Germans' estimate of where the decisive battles will be fought these coming months. A tremendous German offensive in Russia is expected very soon. We return you now to Doug Edwards in New York.
The Japs continue to step up their attacks in the Australian area. General MacArthur's communique tells of more than 100 planes attacking Allied positions in New Guinea, and the Japs timed their raids with a new ground offensive, which thus far doesn't seem to have had any success. In Russia, the battlefields are relatively quiet, but diplomatic activity is increasing. For a report on this activity and the latest war news, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Moscow, Bill Downs reporting.
Any time soldiers make more news than diplomats. However, despite what armies do, it is the diplomats in Russia who now have the job of seeing that our military alliance with Soviet Russia extends beyond an understanding between armies to an understanding between people. I thought you'd be interested in knowing just what kind of men are handling this vitally important task for America and Britain. America's ambassador, Admiral Stanley, who made some headlines of his own a few weeks ago, is still more of a sailor than a diplomat. And this fact alone has made him a success in this country. When he entertains Russian officials at the palatial ambassadorial residence here in Moscow, he starts off by telling them, "Mighty glad to have you aboard." The ambassador thanks in terms of Navy commands, and he runs his office over here like he once ran battleships. It's not a bad way to operate. The British ambassador, Sir Archibald Clark Carter, is just the opposite. He's the Anthony Eden type of diplomat and recognized as one of the most capable men in the British Foreign Service. He is given the Russians what they expect to find in the best type of diplomat, and his success with private officials is due to this fact. As the war approaches a climax and his victory becomes more and more of a reality, these two men are going to have more and more to do here in Moscow. There already are indications that the diplomatic front here in Russia is becoming more active. The latest development to watch is the arrival from America of former Ambassador Joseph Davis. This is Bill Downs returning you now to CBS in New York.
For the past 2 years, it's been impossible for any American radio reporter to broadcast from neutral Switzerland. But right now, CBS correspondent Howard K. Smith, author of Last Train from Berlin, is ready in Bern to bring you a direct report. From this tiny listening post, surrounded by Axis nations and Axis-occupied countries, he will tell you of the repercussions of our great victory in North Africa. Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS Bern, Howard K. Smith reporting.
This is Bern. Reverberations of the Axis collapse in Tunisia are still registering in this listening post today. From Yugoslavia, the radio of the Yugoslav partisans announces an entire company of Italian soldiers deserted their posts as occupation troops in Croatia and joined the partisans en masse when the partisans told them the news in leaflets. The incident occurred outside the northern Yugoslav town Novo Mesto, about 30 miles from the Italian border. In the troubled lands of Western Europe also, Tunis has left its mark. An extraordinary editorial in the Nazi newspaper of Brussels today admits as much. The paper writes, "Belgians are once again putting their heads together and whispering to one another that the Germans are finished. Tunis has poured fresh water over the mills of their little mines." Enraged, the paper writes, "Some of them are so bold as to ask us if we have packed our bags yet." In some places, people can't disguise their glee even that much. In Denmark, for example, the owner of a bookshop was arrested this week for placing large portraits of Hitler and Mussolini in his show window. The pictures were all right, but the only book displayed right between the two pictures was Victor Hugo's Les Misérables. Inside the Reich itself, registrations of the debacle have been less amusing. In Strasbourg, the local Nazi paper reports a youthful terror group is terrorizing the populace. The group's crimes include tearing down Nazi banners on the local Adolf Hitler Square, marking symbols of General de Gaulle on the Strasbourg Cathedral, and breaking show windows which display Nazi symbols. In Munich, the Munich newspaper Neueste Nachrichten reports the number of students now sentenced for belonging to defeatist organizations has reached 20, and it confirms that a Munich University professor and a Stuttgart merchant have been sentenced to death for being respectively the brains and the pocketbook of the organization. Travelers from Germany say a deep pall of gloom has settled down over the Reich after the latest triumph of, as Hitler put it, those eternally drunken men in Washington. However, they deny mischievous reports that the Fuhrer has commissioned Himmler to find out what brand of liquor it is they drink. I now return you to New York.
Back in this country, another CBS reporter is ready to bring you an on-the-spot record of just how the famed Norden bomb site works in action. For this story, Admiral Radio takes you now to an Army bomber flying somewhere along the Atlantic coast, Bill Slocum, Jr. reporting.
I'm sitting now in the goldfish bowl that sticks out of the blunt and ugly nose of a B-24 Liberator, looking for a mock battleship, which I devoutly hope will be the recipient of a devastating 100-pound bomb aimed and released by me with a slight assist, about 90%, by Captain Dick Aaron, who was acting bombardier on this trip. Between my legs is the famous Norden bomb sight, and this will be the first time the releasing and aiming portion of a bombing mission has been heard on the air. The bomb sight is about the same coloring and size of a home movie camera. The bomb sight is, in the simplest possible terms, nothing but a rapid calculating machine. The highly trained bombardier puts certain figures in it, sets the crosshairs on the target, throws a switch, and it bombs away. Captain Aaron is beside me here, and I'm going to ask him to tell us what he's done to the bomb sight, now whirring and whining softly in front of me.
I've put the bomb sight and the temperature zone, and put the temperature, the airspeed, the altitude into the sight. She'll compute ground speed and wind drift. See those little crosshairs inside the rubber eyepiece? If you'll put those on the target, tell the pilot upstairs where to fly, you'll have a hit, or should have.
How do I let the bomb go?
Just put the crosshairs on the target and watch those two pointers. One at the top and one at the bottom. They move toward each other, and when they meet, flip this switch here. There's your target up ahead. Just a minute while I talk to the pilot. Bombardier to pilot.
Pilot to bombardier, go ahead.
Target 165 degrees. Keep it 180 miles per hour. Civilian will bomb.
Roger.
I've got my eye in sight now. It's like looking into a penny arcade filthy picture machine. I can see the target now. It's low and to the left in my sight. Got to put the crosshairs right on the target by turning a tiny wheel at the side. Gone completely out of the sight. There, she's back now. Turn the wheel and the target quickly comes into the middle of the crosshairs. She's in the crosshairs now. Upstairs, our pilot, Major Ed Potter of the Flying Training Command, Sarnfield, watches an indicator that tells him just what I'm doing. His job is to keep this ship level. Back in the bomb sight, I see the target still in the crosshairs. The pointers or indices are slowly drawing together. There it is. Bombs away.
There she goes, Mr. Slocum. Off to the left.
The bomb, a 100-pound blue bullet, shoots along parallel to the plane and faster. Now it dips and heads for the ground. We pass over the Mach battleship now. The bomb is out of sight. Major Potter, can you see it, sir?
Pretty good, mister. Fortunately, the Atlantic down there is no creek. I'd say about 300 feet at 9 o'clock.
300 feet to the left of the target. Well, that won't even rock my battleship, but it'll be well rocked before long, because I have seen the grim young experts studying at the Flying Training Command dropping right down funnels from 4,000 feet. It takes many weary hours to learn how to handle a Norden sight, despite the old Air Force gag that they should commission the Norden bomb sight and leave the bombardier home. I return you now to CBS in New York and Doug Edwards.
The Allied air offensive against Germany and the occupied countries is now in its fifth consecutive day. For a direct report on this and other developments, Admiral Radio takes you now to CBS London, John Daly reporting.
The Allied air campaign against Europe continues. Reports from the southeastern coastal districts of England tell of big formations of planes flying across the Straits of Dover this morning in the direction of northern France. Later, more formations flying at high altitudes crossed the coast, headed in the direction of Holland and Germany. No official details of these operations have been released yet. Last night, the RAF attacked enemy shipping, rail transport, factories, and Berlin. Latest details show wide damage to shipping and railways, and the mosquitoes which attacked Berlin hit their targets and incidentally kept Germany's capital city awake. Meanwhile, German General von Arnim, Axis commander in Tunisia, has arrived in England by air as a prisoner of war. This is Home Guard Day in Britain. Last Thursday was the third birthday of the Home Guard, but all the major celebrations took place today. I have just driven into London from an American army camp in the north of England. And in every village and town through which we passed, the Home Guard in full battle dress, each man with a gun, was on parade. These parades, smart and military, are among the most impressive sights I have seen in more than 3 months in England. I have met a good many of the Home Guard and spent hours talking to them. These men who in 1940 came out of the farms and fields, the offices and shops, and Britain's neat garden-encircled homes to sell their lives dearly. On that tragic day in 1940, May 19th, the call went out from the Prime Minister to the men of England. The call was answered. And today, all of England has paid tribute to these men who armed themselves and moved to protect their land. The tribute has been paid by the King, who took the salute here in London, to the lowliest citizen of the land, who stood on the sidewalk and cheered Tom, Dick, and Harry having their earned day in the sun. Now back to CBS New York and Doug Edwards.
Here in our New York studio is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
We have just heard a report from Howard Smith in Bern, Switzerland, about some of the reports that are coming into that listening post, as he calls it, in the heart of Europe. The tone of the Swiss press with regard to Italy is doubly significant. It suggests, and we must remember that Switzerland is Italy's neighbor, and the Swiss newsmen have something like first-hand knowledge of Italian conditions. It suggests that Italy is on her last legs, that the Italian people are in no mood for a last-ditch fight, and that Italy is fatally weak in the air. The Swiss lay considerable emphasis on Italian defenses along the line of the River Po, which is in northern Italy. Thus, we may take it, the Swiss newsmen are thinking in terms of the complete loss of southern Italy, that is, of the long, narrow boot thrusting out into the Mediterranean. And they are thinking of a determined defense only of the industrial region of the north, the one part of the country, incidentally, which has any real value to Germany. The Swiss papers point out how difficult it would be to defend the narrow boot against an enemy which held Sicily and Sardinia, which commanded the sea and possessed air superiority. All that is quite true, and some observers here have believed that once Sicily and Sardinia are in Allied hands, the peninsular part of Italy will be abandoned by the Italians as indefensible, by the Germans as being of no value, but rather a burden to them. But a stout German-Italian defense along the line of the Po would impose considerable difficulties on Switzerland itself. There would, of course, be all sorts of German pressure on the Swiss to allow the use of their railways for military transit of various types. There seems no doubt that the Swiss are now prepared to say no at the outset to such demands and to stick to it. If the Germans attack, the Swiss are capable of making a stout defense of their mountain regions, and they are assuredly capable of blowing up the great tunnels through which the main lines of railway connecting Germany and Italy pass, so that even the complete conquest of Switzerland would not give the Germans what they seek. Should this happen, the communications of the German-Italian army would be largely dependent on the Brenner Pass line. This attitude on the part of Switzerland is of particular interest because it so closely parallels the case of Sweden, whose communications may also become of importance to Germany. The neutrals of Europe are taking note of the decline of the German sun toward the horizon. They are no longer to be bullied. They are standing firm.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. Now, once again, here's Warren Sweeney with a message from our sponsor.
Admiral Radio, in peacetime the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers, is now turning out radar. The basic principle employed by this amazing weapon of war can best be illustrated in this way. If you have two mirrors and wish to find the distance between them, you can do so theoretically by measuring the time it takes light to flash from one to the other and back again. Radar, now being built by Admiral, works the same way. A radio beam is broadcast. It strikes an object, an enemy plane or ship, and bounces back. Complex precision instruments automatically measure the time elapsed, instantly compute the exact location of the enemy ship or plane. Next week, Admiral will bring you the amazing story of how radar is protecting American flyers against accidents, and the story of why radar is called radar. Today, a major battle is raging on the home front, the battle to hold prices down. Everyone must do his part, farmers, retailers, workers, consumers. Buy only what you really need and pay no more than ceiling prices. Make the things you buy last as long as possible. Eat it all, wear it out, make it do or do without. We must hold the line at every point or face a dangerous rise in living costs. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's Smart Set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you world news today by shortwave, direct from the leading news centers of the world. Warren Sweeney speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.